While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal, I did an awful, awful lot that was wrong.
He said, "Hey, ain't you Jesse Harris?" And I couldn't deny that. I said, "Yeah."
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approved this message.
You know, the job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I said, "Well, I got a good job in Washington. You know what you're doing up there?" I said, "Well, I got a job playing saxophone in a topless bar."
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
He said, "Well, that sure relieves my mind. Some fool told me you got elected to the United States Senate." And I knew that couldn't be so.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Thank you for clicking play. My name is Jeff Tiberi. Today on the program, we turn our focus toward congressional happenings, specifically a couple of special elections here in North Carolina, also an unpaid tax bill, and one member of the U.S. House relenting and moving toward supporting impeachment. Here to discuss those topics and probably a couple of other various and sundry items is Chris Cooper. He's a professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. Professor, welcome back to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
We're 3.5 weeks away from two special elections in the 3rd and 9th districts here in North Carolina. Early voting begins on Wednesday. I want to start in the 9th district. This, of course, the election that was not certified last fall, early this year, due to absentee ballot election fraud. Democrat Dan McCready lost by about 900 votes last November. He's taking another crack at it, opposed by Republican Dan Bishop, state senator from Mecklenburg County, best known perhaps for authoring House Bill 2, well, a member of the North Carolina House. There are additionally two third-party candidates on the ballot. Reminder, this is a conservative-leaning constituency. As we head down the stretch, what are you watching most closely?
You know, I think there's some more ads that are about to hit. So I believe that Bishop has been coming out with a series of ads lately, mostly funded by outside groups. And then on August 16th, Dan McCready is going to put out an ad that's been funded by about $600,000. And so I'm really curious to see, what does that ad look like? Up to this point, Bishop has really tried to tie McCready to national Democratic politics, particularly the squad, whereas McCready sort of avoided that. He really hasn't connected Bishop to national politics. He's talked more about his own record and what he perceives as the problems of Bishop's record. So I'm curious to see if that rhetoric continues moving forward.
Let's stick with that larger theme, which I've noticed in a number of different areas, that the right has tried to paint largely any Democratic candidate as, you know, being very close with Speaker Pelosi, being, you know, friends with the squad or supporters or similar ideologies of the squad. We saw this with a billboard pertaining to Erica Smith, who's a state senator. She's running for U.S. Senate against Tom Tillis. Take me through just a little bit of, well, I guess your observation first, if you are also noticing that, if you see that, and if so, what's the strategy behind that?
Yeah, I am noticing that. And I think this is part of a larger trend. So we've seen political scientists talk a lot about the nationalization of state politics, right? And so more and more we're tying state candidates and even sometimes local candidates to these national issues. So last round, there was even some state legislative elections with pictures of national politicians together, or national politicians with state politicians, right? This is part of this bigger trend. And I think for Bishop, this is obviously reflecting his awareness that this is a Republican-leaning district. There are only two districts in our entire country that are more Republican than the ninth that are represented by Democrats. In other words, this is a fairly Republican district, so you would think you could make a lot of hay connecting McCready to this national Democrats who probably aren't too popular in the ninth congressional district.
And this is, just remind me if you recall, this is an R plus 8 or 9 district. President Trump won the 9th congressional district by almost double digits, right?
He did. He won 53.4% of the vote in the last round. So, yes, this is the 8th most Republican district in the state of North Carolina as far as Trump vote in the last round.
When we look at candidates being painted as perhaps further to the left or further to the right than they actually are. I mean, we don't know a ton about McCready. He hasn't held public office before. But he, by most accounts and what we can gather, is not particularly progressive. He's probably not an extreme Democratic candidate. Is that done because it's, at least in part, because it's easy to digest, because there's so much attention that's being paid to some of these more progressive members of the U.S. House?
No, I think that's exactly right. People don't have a strong opinion about McCready. They know he's in the military, probably. They know that he's fairly young. They know that he doesn't have much of a voting record. But people are sort of vaguely aware of the Squad, and I think the Squad has become sort of the new symbol of the far left that the right is trying to use. So we're seeing that in the Ninth. We're even seeing that kind of down the road from me in Cherokee County, North Carolina. There was a local gun shop that actually had a picture of the Squad up on a billboard that made national news. So I think people all over the state, all over the country are vaguely aware of the Squad. I think the idea is the Republican voters aren't real fond of them. People may not know much about McCready. So if you tie somebody you don't know much about to somebody you don't like, that's probably a pretty good or pretty effective campaign strategy.
Should President Trump get credit for this? I mean, is this a narrative that he has largely conjured up, or is this something that we have seen, previous iterations of in earlier cycles of politics?
I mean, I think, like most things in politics recently, there was kind of a fire burning and Trump sort of poured some gas on top of it and increased it, right? I think we saw this nationalization happening before Trump. We saw people trying to connect politicians to unpopular politicians for an awful long time. But I think that has certainly increased with Trump. And I think you can watch who Trump seems to attack, and then you can see politicians lower down the food chain attack those same politicians. So it's sort of presenting one united front from the party.
Here's a random follow-up that we might end up throwing in the trash bin. But as we think about in which state is there the greatest familiarity with governors or state leaders, if you know? I mean, are there states that do this better than others? Because here in North Carolina, I mean, Phil Berger and Tim Moore, despite being pretty powerful people, have just abysmal name recognition with the public.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's true in most states. Look, state legislators, by and large, aren't very well known. Governors, to some degree, are. My guess is that the name recognition is much higher in smaller states with fewer media markets, right? So I'm talking to you today from Cullowhee, North Carolina. We can get on the internet and we can find news coming out of Raleigh, but you can also find news real easily coming out of Georgia, coming out of Tennessee, and coming out of South Carolina. So a state like North Carolina that's pretty big, that's got a lot of states bordering it, that's got kind of a messy media market landscape, I think you're going to tend to have lower name recognition than maybe you would in a state with just one or two media markets where people are going to be more familiar with the candidates. They might also even be more likely just to bump into them.
All right. So in this ninth congressional race, let's reset just a little bit with McCready and Bishop, and again, a couple of candidates from smaller, lesser known parties. This is a Republican constituency. McCready didn't win last year, and last year was, call it whatever you want, a wave, a ripple, a tsunami. If he couldn't win last year, tell us why he could win this year.
I think he could win this year, one, because he was extraordinarily close. Two, because, as everybody knows, there's all sorts of questions about who would have really won that election were it not for we'll just call them shenanigans, that took place. So I think that's one reason why. I think there is kind of this hypothesis, if you will, this educated guess that people have that says, hey, maybe all the shenanigans last time kind of put a pall over the Republican Party. Maybe people don't trust the Republican candidate and kind of feel like they need to give McCready a chance. McCready's also been a prodigious fundraiser before, and he's a prodigious fundraiser now. I think there's a sense that maybe Trump is, you know, perhaps underwater and maybe not that popular in North Carolina. I think that's the case that why it would be different. The case why it would be the same, I think, is just the demographics of this district. Again, this is a 53.4% of these voters voted for Donald Trump. You've got Dan McCready, who's in some ways an attractive candidate, but does not have elected experience, going against somebody who does have elected experience and probably had a little bit higher name recognition.
Shenanigans. Should I not be calling it election fraud?
Yeah. I think election fraud is probably the right term to use.
Right.
I opted for shenanigans because I'm not quite through this cup of coffee yet.
Okay, fair enough. Chris Cooper here on the WNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Cooper WCU. No, no relation to Roy Asbury, the governor of North Carolina. Let's move to the 3rd District. This is the race to replace the late Walter Jones, who died back in February. Republican candidate Greg Murphy, he's a three-term member of the North Carolina House. The Democrat is Alan Thomas, a former multiple-term mayor of Greenville. This is an even deeper red constituency than the one we were just talking about. Strikes me as though there would need to be an almost act of God for Thomas, the Democrat, to pull off what I think a lot of political folks like yourself would call a major upset. How do you view this one?
Yes, I view this one. I think it would be a tough pull for the Democrats to win the 9th. It would be extraordinary if the Democrats somehow won the 3rd congressional district. So this is a district that was won 60.5%. 60.5% of those voters in that district voted for Donald Trump last time. It's the third highest, third most Republican, third most Trump-friendly in the state. You've got a lot smaller numbers, so I think that's a fundraising. So I think that's another sign that even the National Democratic Party, that's still putting a lot of money into McCready, is not putting very much money into the 3rd. So there's only one member of Congress who's a Democrat who represents a more Republican district than the 3rd in North Carolina. So this would be, if not historic, it would be still extraordinary if the Democrats somehow pulled this out.
So the 3rd district stretches from the northeast part of the state, comes down and grabs the eastern part of Greenville, goes all the way down toward the southeast part of the state and encompasses Camp Lejeune, the largest military base in the United States and in the world. I want to acknowledge that's the 3rd district now. The 3rd has changed over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years with redistricting and re-redistricting. Mm-hmm. Give me a sense, because you're talking about how red it is now. Just remind us how less red it used to be in recent years as we think about kind of the coastal plains voters. They've moved more to the right, have they not?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I think the voters have certainly moved to the right in this district. I think most any indicator we have of that is going to suggest that this was a red district that went redder over time for a variety of reasons, both those that are kind of external and those that are really just internal to the people who happen to live there. So it's been represented by Walter Jones, right, who was this Republican who was not really a far-right Republican. So in some ways, he was, I would argue, a little bit more liberal than the district as a whole. So I think we would expect to see not just a Republican in this district. I think we would expect to see a Republican who's going to be more to the right of Jones.
North Carolina has 13 U.S. House seats, likely to get a 14th as part of reapportionment. And I'm probably butchering that word when we do the next census and round of redistricting in 2020 and 2021. Of those 13 seats, 10 currently held by Republicans, 3 by Democrats. Already in the U.S. House from North Carolina, one of those Democrats, David Price, he's been there for much of the last 30 years. This week, the Democrat from Chapel Hill moved into the camp of progressives and Democrats who are supporting an inquiry of impeachment against President Donald Trump. For context, just a month ago, Price voted against impeachment proceedings. Why the change, and how significant do you view this?
I think the change is, you know, certainly a political one. I think he is probably, you know, reading the tides a little bit, certainly of his own district, but maybe of the national mood. As far as how significant, I don't know that this is very significant. Obviously, Pelosi has said that she is not, or indicated anyway, that she's not for impeachment. I don't think impeachment's going to happen. I think this is a symbolic move by Price. Symbols can be important in politics. We certainly talk about them, but I sincerely doubt that President Trump will be impeached before the next election.
Kind of a worthless hypothetical, but what could change that in your mind?
New information that we just don't know. And obviously new information that turned Republican voters against Donald Trump. And so that's difficult to imagine, but, it's difficult to imagine all sorts of things that haven't happened yet. So I would say anything that would change the electoral fortunes of Republicans supporting Trump would be the kind of thing that would all of a sudden change the probability of impeachment very, very quickly.
I want to ask you also, I think probably just briefly, about another one of those U.S. House incumbents from North Carolina, Republican from your neck of the woods, Mark Meadows, founder, co-founder, chair of the Freedom Caucus, hardline group of Republicans, big supporter of Donald Trump. It was revealed this week that he owed some back taxes, some property taxes from, I believe it was like 80-plus acres of land in northeastern North Carolina, nowhere near where he lives and serves. How big of a deal? Is this a big deal, a medium deal, or a no deal kind of situation?
It's somewhere between no deal and a medium deal. So I think he owes around $6,000, it looks like. So
$6,200, you know, I believe, the reporting. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I believe it was $6,200, the reporting said.
$6,200, yeah. So a chunk of change for folks like us, but not a huge sum of money in the scheme of kind of the wealth of members of Congress. I think this is going to be looked at more as an accounting error than anything else. It looks like the business that he owned was in Highlands, North Carolina, and then I think it was moved to a P.O. box kind of closer to Asheville, and then it was moved back to Highlands. So it does seem like he should have had knowledge of this, but I don't see this having huge electoral implications. I don't see this having a big ethics scandal. His spokespeople are claiming that he's, you know, already writing the check right now. So I would expect this will be taken care of fairly quickly, and I think this will likely go away.
Chatting congressional happenings here on the WNC Politics Podcast, I want to drift toward national politics of a different vein and ask you about this huge Democratic field of presidential hopefuls, or of hopefuls, I guess, first for the nominee to take on, presumably, President Donald Trump in the 2020 election. We got news, it felt like finally we got news this week that John Hickenlooper had dropped out of the race after about 6 months, former Denver mayor, former two-term governor of Colorado. And one of the questions, almost like just a barstool question that I've been posing to people, is what is the, and I realize you're not advising them, but what's the approach here for, or was, for Hickenlooper, Montana governor, Steve Bullock, a guy who's polling at, I think, about 0.6%, and then even Beto O'Rourke, who's the former U.S. House member from Texas, who's also in this race but really hasn't caught on. I ask about those three because they're kind of hanging on, and I would use the word floundering, in this mm-hmm. Democratic, this large Democratic primary contest, despite the fact that there are U.S. Senate races in those three states, and the polls and the people who are a lot smarter than me seem to indicate that they would be viable and competitive candidates. So my question, as I round back to it, is what's the philosophy here? Why are people hanging on in this race for so long when it appears they have really no chance?
I mean, I think there's probably a few reasons. One is, you know, presidential candidates are delusional. I think that is one thing we know from, you know, kind of reading, you know, tons of retrospectives of campaigns over time, is that folks who are down might think that they have a chance, and especially in a field this big, it wouldn't take much to have some real big movement quickly. So I think that's probably part of it. I think part of it is the sunk cost that people feel like they have in a campaign. They have an entire campaign apparatus. They are paying campaign workers. They have supporters. They probably don't want to let those folks down. And the other is, I think some folks just want a national profile. I think Beto O'Rourke is a great example of this, right? I mean, Beto O'Rourke was a member of Congress that, I'll speak frankly, I didn't really know much about before he decided to run for Senate. He now has a national profile. That's a national profile that he can parlay into speaking engagements. He might be able to parlay into appearances on CNN. He's a national player in a way that he just wouldn't be, I think, if he were running yet another time for Senate. So I think we're going to see some more winnowing happen. Whether that happens with Beto O'Rourke, I'm not sure. But I think we would, you know, some of these folks who seem like moderate governors like Hickenlooper from purple states that aren't catching much, I think are probably going to drop out pretty soon.
My social media feeds and just in chatting with other folks have been hearing about some of these political ads. I think we, for months now, have been seeing these testimonials, these asks from U.S. senators and other candidates for dollar pledges, right, to help them get back on the debate stage. There have been some solicitations about, you know, donate and have an opportunity to have, I believe it's pizza with Mayor Pete. You can win pizza with the Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend. I saw one this week that was grab a beer, and then in parentheticals it was or coffee or tea or whatever with Elizabeth Warren. Again, I think you had to make a donation, and then you would be in a drawing of some sort. Going to throw you on the spot here.
Sure.
If you were going to have a meal, a drink, a something with one of the Democratic candidates, what would you like to have and where would you want to do it?
You know, I'm intrigued by the or whatever on Elizabeth Warren, but I'll avoid that. I would say I would probably – I'm interested in Mayor Pete in that I'm interested in how somebody who is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, so in kind of North Carolina terms, the mayor of Hickory, North Carolina – might think that he can be president of the United States. And I think anybody who has that kind of ambition from that kind of seat would be worth having a beer with. So I would probably say Mayor Pete. I would probably say the drink would be at Burial Brewing Company in Asheville.
Nice.
And I would probably want to get the Surf Wax IPA.
Nice. That's very specific. I was worried you were going to be like, oh, I don't know. I'll give that some thought. That was a really good answer. I like it.
Thank you.
I was having a conversation with my wife recently. She went to Carolina, and we were talking about and wondering really aloud about the vibe on college campuses and how much they have changed in the last few years, last couple of decades. I graduated from school 13 years ago. My wife is a couple of years younger than I am. You've been on college campuses pretty consistently for what, like 20, 25 years now? Is that?
Something like that.
Not to make you feel old.
No, it's true.
How much has the vibe on college campuses, as we think about safe spaces and trigger words and just the overall environment, how much has it changed from your perspective?
You know, it's changed, but I will say this is one where I think the national conversation, the national media is focused so much on elite institutions. So, look, I didn't go to Harvard. I can't weigh in on how the Ivy League has changed. I take people at their word that those kind of institutions have changed radically. But, you know, most students aren't going to those kind of universities, and that is not the most common university. So I think at a place like Western Carolina or App State or UNCG or UNCC or UNCW, I think there's been some changes. Students are activated in some different ways than they were before, but I don't know that it is a radically different environment. So we did a poll a few years ago with the Chronicle Higher Education about partisan ID essentially of North Carolina campuses. And Western Carolina, where I am, came out kind of right in the middle, right? We about 50-50 Democrat and Republican. We had a bunch of Republicans. We had a bunch of Democrats. This was not a super liberal environment. It wasn't a super conservative environment. And I haven't seen a lot that's changed in the intervening years. So it's different, but I don't think it is as different at most universities than people tend to perceive.
He teaches political science and public affairs. You have degrees, I do believe, from Winthrop University, and then you did graduate degrees, master's, and your PhD at the University of Tennessee. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Little stalking, internet stalking, never hurt anybody. That's actually not true. I'm sure it has hurt people, but no one was hurt in that instance right there.
No. This is public.
Are you a Vol? Are you a volunteer? Are you a fan of the Vols?
Oh, yeah, big fan.
Big fan. Okay. Just wondering, because you
It's been more difficult since 1998, but I am still a fan.
Why do you say that? You mean they won the national title and then they haven't been back?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. All right.
Title in 98, they lost Phil Fulmer, and they have been less exciting to watch since.
I would be remiss if on this podcast I didn't at least note that you were a recent witness in a partisan gerrymandering case that's playing out here in state court. We're not going to chat about that today because there hasn't been a decision rendered in that. So we'll just note that and move on. One more question I did want to get to you before we part ways here. This budget dilemma that's playing out in Raleigh, day 47 now. When do you think that this impasse is going to conclude, if you have a sense?
You know, so if the past is any guide, I think we're not in uncharted territory yet. So if you go back and you look at every budget we passed in North Carolina since 2001, there were 2 years that were still farther, that were later than we are currently. In other words, two times since 2001, we've had budgets that were actually not passed until September. So if I had to take a bet, I would say somewhere in mid to late September, just because that seems to be towards the end of what North Carolinians and the North Carolina General Assembly is willing to take. If it goes much past September, we are in completely uncharted territories in North Carolina.
That is optimism, and we will take it. As we have been kicking around the press, I'm not convinced we have a new budget in 2019, but
wow.
It will. I'm not going to object to there being I don't care either way, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, it certainly takes some air out of the room, and it is a little bit draining from the reporter standpoint, but it will be very interesting to see when this debate over state spending and the Medicaid, so on and so forth, finally concludes. Chris Cooper teaches public affairs and political science in Cullowhee, also sometimes in Asheville. He's a faculty member at Western Carolina University. Professor, as always, appreciate the time.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, Jeff.
A quick request before we depart this week, wondering who it is you would like to hear on the podcast. We had some of the more well-known names in state politics these past few weeks, and as you know, generally we try to make an effort to mix in some academics, strategists, and media types as well. But if there is someone that you are thinking you would like to hear more from in the North Carolina political sphere, please let me know. You can shoot me an email, find me on Twitter, @J_Tibbs, that's T-I-B-S. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this program on iTunes, Google Play, as well as Stitcher, and you can stay up to date with much of what's happening at your state legislature via our website, wunc.org. For Chris Cooper, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Once two strangers climbed old Rocky Top looking for a moonshine still. Strangers ain't come down from Rocky Top, reckon they never will. Corn won't grow at all on Rocky Top, dirt's too rocky by far. That's why all the folks on Rocky Top get their corn from a jar. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee.